Hey, Gordo. So welcome to the 58th ranked sports podcast in the world, according to iTunes.
Up to 58th now. I haven't checked in the last, a week or so ago that we last talked, and you're at 119, I think. So that's a pretty significant improvement. My hat's off.
Yeah, thanks. I don't know what I did, but thank you. I'm doing it really good, whatever's happening.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with the fellas on the ice winning that series and promoting you guys, you know, everyone wearing the t-shirts, all that stuff. I think it was all you and your genius writing.
I completely agree. And I'm benching Peter for this podcast and going to a former Capitals player who is also the nicest human on the planet Earth, because I thought that would be a nice switch up today. So
no offense, Peter.
But yeah, man, how have you been doing?
Good. I'm back home in Canada now. It's obviously our European season is a lot shorter. The schedule is just sort of condensed differently. We start earlier and we end earlier, and my team lost in the first round again this season, so it's kind of a letdown. I'm home a little bit earlier than I'd anticipated, than I would have liked, but it's another good year, an enjoyable year, and I'm excited to be back and spending some time with my family, my parents and my sister, who I haven't seen in 8 or 9 months. So it's been a good couple of weeks back home, just getting back into things slowly, and looking forward to the next season already, if you will.
Now, explain to the people at home where basically you live up in Canada. You live awfully close to a certain someone, correct?
Yes, I'm. What I'm most known for is being Sydney's relative neighbor, I guess you could say. So, you know, Sidney Crosby's hometown is about 10, 15 minutes down the road from, you know, my parents' house from where I grew up. So we're my little city is called Porter's Lake, Nova Scotia, and we're probably about 5 kilometers from the Atlantic Ocean, from all the beaches and then waves crashing. And we're about 35 minutes out of Halifax, like the capital city of the province. We're a pretty little remote city, about 2,000 people, just off the coast of Halifax.
Now, can you explain to people back home as well what kilometers are? Because I don't know what that is.
Yeah, well, I'm used to it now because here we do it. In Europe, they do it. But you guys are the only oddballs who seem to think that you're special.
Oh oddballs. Oddballs. Now you're throwing name calling out there. Okay.
Well, when the entire globe uses, kilometers and all this stuff, and you guys seem to go your own direction, I feel like the Americans have this block where they just don't want to conform to the rest of us.
I mean, we get it. We have lots of guns. We have lots of fast food. I don't know where this is going.
And lots of miles in between.
We're very wise. We're a very, very wise country. I don't know what you're talking about.
In Sweden, actually, they have a different system altogether. There's a thing called like a Swedish mile. So they'll say, oh yeah, I'm going to go, I got my cottage, it's like, 3 miles away. And a Swedish mile, I think, is like 20 kilometers or something, or 10 kilometers.
Wow.
So when the Swedes refer to a mile, they're talking about a Swedish mile is like 10 kilometers.
Oh, wow.
That's even goofier to me. So like you're using one system, using a word for another one, and you're just putting together an arbitrary number of kilometers to make a mile. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Whatever. Well, I really want to talk to you about this Caps Pens series. So, let's play the theme music and let's get to that. Welcome back, Gordo. This is the Armin B podcast.
Let's do it.
And now it's time for the RMNB podcast.
Okay, Gordo, so first I have to ask you, the Caps, for the first time in 20 years, are going to the Eastern Conference Final. They could not get over the hump in, I think, Alex Ovechkin's first 13 years as a player in the NHL. So my question to you, as a former player, How did you see that victory? How did you feel? Did you feel anything? Like, did it mean something special to you? Or, you know, like, I just, that the thing for me is I just cannot, when it happened for me, I just couldn't believe it. It didn't seem real.
Well, I mean, it's, there's still some guys that I, you know, I haven't talked to some of these guys, you know, in probably 5-7 years. It's sort of a heartwarming thing to see guys like, you know, that I played with, guys like Holtby and guys like Carlson, Beegs, and you know, these people who I had some very formative years early in my career with, finally get over that hump, and you can see the emotion on their faces. You can see, you know, how much of a weight was just lifted off everybody in the whole organization's shoulders. So I think I almost felt a little piece of that myself, thinking, you know, like, oh, like, you know, the guys that I have a big heart for in an organization, a franchise that I have a big heart for, finally sort of can shed this dark cloud that's been hanging over for the better part of a decade. And it was a big sort of a relief almost for me as well. But I mean, even though the series ended in six, I think it didn't come without its share of back and forth, without its share of scary moments. So they did it in style, and you know, it's to sort of slay the dragon that's been in their way for so long in Pittsburgh has got to, you know, feel even more special, let alone just getting to the conference final. But to beat Pittsburgh on your way, it's got to be an enormous emotional boost for those guys.
Yeah, I've never, you know, Ovi kind of went into like a dead inside mode for the last 10 years or so, where he's still fun, but you can kind of tell that inside he's dying. But after they won, like in his interviews and everything, he's just like, he has the biggest smile. It was like when he first came into the league. It's been so adorable, really, frankly, to watch, you know, and it's, to me, it's just been so much of a relief that the team finally got over the hump. I mean, it almost became comical in a sense, because how do you lose 9 of 10 to one team in the playoffs? You know what I mean?
Statistically, yeah, it was bound to happen. So obviously it wasn't going to carry on forever, but I mean, for Ovi, I have to feel like it's a especially an enormous relief, because it does. When people look at these series and look at the numbers, they always say, okay, Crosby is a success because he did this. Ovi's a failure because Washington did this. And it's not – I feel like so much of the onus just goes right on him and right on his shoulders, and he's a target. And the, you know, postseason interviews, everyone's just questioning, why him, why him, why him? Why can't he win? Why can't he win? And so to get that, you know, satisfaction of finally getting over that hump is the analogy we're going to keep – beating into the ground, but to get over that hump and to win that series and to have people from here on out not be able to say he can't do it has to be a great feeling. And now that they're, so I read an article recently that said that their Caps must feel right now that they're just playing with house money, because they've already, you know, they're already ahead of where they've been for so long that they got to be feeling pretty loose and feeling like, you know, they slayed that dragon, they're on to the next round, and now there's no curse hanging over them, there's no, it's time to make some new history, and now this is the new normal. Getting to the conference finals has to become that new normal.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I've seen that's been kind of debated, like locally with local sites or has been, is this season, like I saw a poll recently, I think by NBC Sports Washington, that was, do you find this season a success after getting past the second round? And then they had the second answer was, or possible answer was, no, I think they need to win the Stanley Cup or it's a failure still. And more people picked the Stanley Cup than the second round. I don't know if I'm in the minority, but I absolutely think this season was a success, especially after how many players they shed over the offseason, how they kind of cobbled the team together at the very end of the year. It's been... For me, I agree. It's like, it is house money. Is whatever happens after this, you know, they can kind of relax. Like I can imagine that they've had a monkey off their back finally, and they can really go out and have fun. And that's actually something I wanted to ask you about, was that, you know, you've played in a lot of postseason series throughout your career, and you've gone very deep with the Hershey Bears. And like you said recently with Linkoping, you know, you guys have had some first round ousters. Is there something to the having fun? Because before the season, Brian McClellan said that the team kind of played with too much pressure, and he just said he wanted them to enjoy the moment and just focus individually on playing the best they could, not really worrying about the result.
Well, going into last season, I mean, being 2 years ago, there was this, the term that kept being thrown around was, this year is the Caps are Stanley Cup or bust. You know, there's going to be so many players leaving. It's cup or bust, cup or bust. And when that's your mentality, every mistake is amplified. And every mistake, you're just under the microscope and everyone's expecting you to, you know, do all these great things. But winning is so hard. I cannot express this enough, people. As fans, you sit in your armchair with a bag of chips on your right and complain about why they can't win. But it is so hard to win. And it's so hard. It's even harder to win when you're supposed to. I'm using air quotes here. To win when you're supposed to is, I think, one of the hardest things in sports. So it's easy to play hard and just go out there and whatever happens, happens. But when you're expected by everybody to win and you don't, then suddenly you're this big failure. That's a lot of pressure. And I think they had that last season. So media all summer this past year just flipped that on its head. They're saying rebuilding year, they're gonna struggle at this position, they're gonna struggle here, they're gonna need to have some influence from some third, fourth line players here or there. So there was a different mentality altogether. They didn't have any talk of winning the Stanley Cup. And I think that probably worked for them, like you said, playing without that sense of, you know, I must win or else I'm a failure. And then ended up, you know, like they were dangerously close if they didn't win the division. I forget what the numbers were. But it turned out to be a very positive regular season. And they went into the playoffs thinking, like, hell, why the hell not? Why not us? And so it's been I think it's been a great season for them to play without that pressure. Does a Stanley Cup ultimately define success in this sport? Yes, winning does define success. And I think I don't think anybody in the locker room is going to tell you, yeah, you know, we're pretty satisfied with this. We're just going to stop playing right now and just, you know.
I'd be that one guy. No, I'd be that one guy. I'd be like, you know what? You know what? All of you guys have been criticizing us for 2 seconds. I'm good. I'm good. I tried my best. I didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, I had my man, coach.
Has anyone ever joked with you that they would say that to the media, by the way?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't think – it's just – you just don't say that stuff to each other. Don't wanna, like, even if you're thinking it sometimes, I know guys are probably thinking, ah, you know what? Especially in the American League, guys go out and, you know, score a point a game all regular season. They're a free agent next year thinking, hey, I had a big year. I kind of want to go to my summer. You know, that's it's easy to break teams and break individual players' will in the minors because there's really no upside to winning. You know, you win multiple Calder Cups, that's not going to get you to the NHL. You got to play your way there. Just being a winner in the American League doesn't ensure that you're going to make it your way up. But in the NHL, I think, I mean, the Stanley Cup is the epitome. It's everything. It's everything. So I think that I don't think anybody in that dressing room or anybody in any NHL dressing room wins or even gets to the finals and says, oh, we're outmanned here. We'd better just roll over and lose the Stanley Cup. I don't think that's really talked about ever.
One thing during the Caps-Pens series that has been different, too, is that I hate this kind of narrative stuff, but it's the only way I can describe it. The Caps owned the big moments in the series. And again, I don't know really how to explain that per se, but it was even just like that Game 6 overtime goal that Evgeny Kuznetsov scored where Kuzi kind of bumped the puck off Sidney Crosby's stick. It kind of goes right to Ovechkin. And Ovechkin just feeds it up to him and he scores. You know, there was a few, you know, Pittsburgh lost a goal earlier in the series. I think it was Carl Hagelin. No, it was Patrick Hornquist, where he banged home a rebound. And then we learned about the parallax view. Did you see that?
Yeah, that was a big debate there for a couple of days anyway. But the media just rolls through everything so fast now because there's so much going on.
I know.
It was really under the spotlight there for a day.
But it's stuff like that where – If that was the Capitals in years past, that would have gone against them. You know what I mean? And like this year, for whatever reason, some cosmic thing has changed and, you know, they're just dinking around, having a good time and winning. You know, they went down two games in the first round to Columbus, both in overtime. That should have been soul crushing for this team. And then they went four straight.
I vented on you about this at one point during that series.
Yeah.
Heaven forbid you put your Vezina trophy winner in for game one of the playoffs.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, we should talk about that.
Heaven forbid you start your MVP.
Were you there when were you still in the organization when Groovy was drafted? I forget.
I think he was drafted, but he never played with us in the minors. I never crossed paths with him.
Yeah, what would you have done in that situation? Because let me kind of lay out the context first, because that sounds easy to play, you know, your Vezina trophy guy. But, you know, I think it was about a month and a half earlier, Holtby started struggling. I think the problem was is that the Caps defense was giving up a lot of high danger chances, and he started trying to make saves beyond who he was, perhaps. And I think mentally he was starting to get really frustrated. I mean, there was reports several times of him kind of screaming at guys in the locker room during intermission. So they gave him a quote-unquote reset. About 2 weeks of basically working with Mitch Korn and the Caps' current goaltending coach, Scott Murray. And basically, Grubauer ran with it. He was dominant. He, statistically speaking, he made some of the most saves on high danger shots, percentage-wise, in the NHL. I think he finished second to Sergei Bobrovsky this season, and just high in percentage of high danger shots stopped. And he was fantastic. He had more shutouts than Holtby. He looked unbelievable. So you have a guy who's just hot. But yeah, you also do have your former Vezina Trophy winner, who's one of the best goaltenders in playoff history, at least in terms of just general save percentage. So what would have you done in that situation? Because that's a tough conversation either way.
Yeah, no, I agree. Given the way things played out in the last month or so of the season, you obviously want to go with a goaltender who you have confidence in. But if it's me, I have confidence in the guy who I've been watching dominate this league and dominate the playoffs for how many years now? So, I mean, if you needed to give him some time late in the season to reset, refocus, I would have just stuffed as much confidence into this guy as I could. I would have said, Holtby, take a couple weeks off. We're going to put you in here and there. Give Gruby some games to keep him in the rhythm, because any team that goes deep in the playoffs needs two goalies. Something's going to happen. Yeah. You need that. You don't want to throw a guy in who's ice cold. But I would have said, we're going to go back with you, and, you know, late in the season, last couple of games and into the playoffs. We need you to just get your head right now and use this time to your advantage. I would have just kept stuffing him with this. Talks periodically about how the team has faith in him, and he's been our guy, and he's going to be our guy. And then I would have put him in the last game of the season, put him in game one. I think, I mean, I use this question with you too. Like, if Ovi didn't score a single goal for the last 15 games of the year, do you scratch him first game of the playoffs? These are your horses. These are the guys that you count on. You cannot win a Stanley Cup if these players aren't playing well. And so,
To be fair, Barry is going to scratch Nathan Walker after tallying a huge assist in Game 6. So perhaps maybe he won't.
Okay, that's another very small sample size. So Nathan scored a goal in his first ever game. It like hit him in the ass as he was looking in the wrong direction. Does that mean should we put him in the All-Star game?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great ass.
So I mean, I don't know. It's if it's me, like I said, you got to let your horses run, and you got to go with the guys who got you there. Dance with the girl you came with, as I like to say. And Holtby's the guy, and he's always going to be the guy. And you want Gruby to feel good too, and you want him to be part of the whole process and say, okay, we're giving you these minutes and these games because you are playing lights out, and we love that about you, and we're going to need you to be honed in and play lights out if you get in the playoffs. And I would tell Holtby, you're going in to start the playoffs because you're our guy and we want you to roll, but you got kind of a short leash because Ruby's playing deadly too. So like, know that there is still competition. So I would make it a clear statement that you are the guy. We believe in you 1,000,000%. But, you know, if we lose a game or two, we're going to have to roll things over because he's playing great too on your heels. So, and things like that motivate a guy like Holtby. You said he's calling guys out in the dressing room and everything. As a goalie, you don't see that. Goalies are quiet and they sit in the corner and they're weirdos. Holtby is a guy who competes and he's going to, you know, block puck with his face and he's going to do anything and he's going to get in guys' faces and he's going to slash people. And that's the intensity and the competition you want. And in the playoffs, what more could you ask for from a goalie and a guy who battles?
All right, so we're going to have to back up here on the sit in the corner and be weirdos. I'm going to need some context on that.
Goalies are weirdos. I think that's been commonplace for 100 years, as long as a sport's been a sport. Goalies are just weird individuals. They have a different rhythm. Holtby has all his Holtbyisms that you guys are always posting online and stuff, and that's where he's weird. But he approaches the game like a physical defenseman. You know, he has this warrior mentality that I think you don't see in goalies very often. Mostly they're quiet guys who have their little routines and this and that. Eddie Lack, who has been struggling the last couple of years, but Eddie Lack's the only goalie I ever played with, ever, who was a DJ of a dressing room. and I thought, this guy's weird. If he, you know, he's the only, he's the oddball out because he's the goalies like to be in their little zone and they like to have their own bubble. But Eddie would be like, you know, 5 minutes before the game, going out and changing the song and like yelling guys at guys and doing weird stuff. And so he's the only outgoing dressing room party guy that I've seen as a goalie. Most of the time, they literally sit in the corner and are just quiet, focusing in being weirdos.
I just find that so funny. Like, did Michael Neuvert ever do anything? Now that I'm really interested.
There's never been a guy who has sat in the corner and like you didn't notice he was in the room more than Michael Neuvert. I think it was my second year that I first talked to Newbie.
Oh gosh, really?
Super quiet, super weird. No, he wasn't that weird. He didn't have any, you know, strange nuances about him, but he was a guy that, like I said, he's going to do his thing. Goalies don't always – they don't go in the gym and do the same workouts we do. Goalies don't prepare for the game the same way we do. Goalies don't go out and warm up the same way we do. So it's literally like – it's like they're the kickers and the rest of us are the, you know, the rest of the football team and the O-line and all that stuff who's doing their physical stuff, getting grinded on. The goalies are just the kickers who go and do their own special thing.
Do you think that part of it is because – is, you know, I don't think it's appreciated how hard being a goaltender is too, because doesn't Holtby have to drink like, I think I read he drinks like 10 bottles of like water before every game and things of that nature. Like it's more of a physical challenge, you know, and I assume mentally you just have to be really sharp because a lot of it is reacting, correct?
Yeah. And mentally it's gotta be really taxing because a player that plays a lot of minutes is playing 18, 20 minutes, a defenseman, maybe a few more, but if you play 20 minutes, you're playing a lot. And so there's 40 minutes of game where you're just sort of, you know, you can talk to the guy beside you and you can, you know, take a drink of water and you're looking at plays on the board and you're talking to the coaches. You're mentally doing other things except for being honed in on the play at all times. And the goalies don't have that luxury. So they're mentally, they have to be able to focus for a long, long extended period of time. They have to be doing it all alone. They're not on the bench mixing it up with the boys kind of thing. They're not bouncing plays and bouncing scenarios off each other. He's just in there mulling over what happened. And so if he let in a goal early or on a bad goal, he's not having someone tap him on the butt saying, you're fine, we got you. He's down there mulling it over. So the goalies have to have a different mind frame altogether. And also playing 60 minutes, I mean, he's in a deep half squat, holding his legs and holding his glutes and everything in a painful position for long periods of time. Physically, it's a different sport altogether, but it is hard. I mean, if for anybody, myself included, I put on goalie skates and goalie gear once probably in the last 15 years just as a laugh, and it sucks. I mean, you're trying to figure out your angles, and you're trying to figure, is this guy going to shoot? Is he taking it to the backhand? Because you got to be ready to move, and you got to be ready to stay still. And you got to, it's the reads that these guys are making, and the NHL goalies are so good now. It's crazy. It's crazy how good they are and how hard that position really is.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that really, if you look 1 through 30, or I guess 32 now, almost all the guys are pretty close. Like the difference between 1 to 32 is very, very close. And there's some guys outside of the league that probably could be in that ranking as well. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
Going back to the Capital Series really quick, that was a very interesting conversation about goalies. One of the things that we wrote about before Game 6, which I thought was really cool, and, you know, you were there when people criticized Ovi's leadership and, you know, Brooks Lech should be captain, blah, 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 blah. And that morning, before the morning skate, so apparently this is a thing, and I don't know if it was a thing back when you were playing, but every day of a morning skate, Jay Beagle does a quote-unquote hot lap where it's almost like he's a NASCAR guy on doing a victory lap around the ice. So he does like a 100% all out lap to start the morning skate every time they play. And so during game 6, Ovi tapped him on the butt and said, I'm going to do it. And then he went out and everybody was laughing and cheering and everything. And I thought that was actually like one of those really, really big, it seems stupid. You know, like I don't want to like overanalyze something that isn't a humongous deal. But I thought that was just such a big leadership moment, and to kind of basically be like Ovi is telling his teammates, you know what? I'm going to do the little things to win. You know, if you look at what happened with Backstrom, with him hurting his hand, you know, it was him blocking a shot. But, you know, it just seems like all the guys are kind of just really gelling together. And, you know, that leadership stuff, would that have a big impact on you?
Stuff in the morning skate, I think that's a great way to lighten the mood. I mean, everyone's coming in the morning. It's obviously a big game. Everyone's mentally on edge a little bit. You're going to go through your meetings. The guys are breaking down the last game. They're showing you the power play clips. They're making changes. There's a lot of speculation that morning about if Backstrom was playing. Things are, like I said, guys would be on edge. And to do something like that just to, you know, electrify the boys a little bit. You can see, I saw the clip. They played it on Hockey Night Canada. You can see the clip of all the boys on the bench just hooting and hollering and beating the glass with their sticks. And it was just a way to lighten the mood. And I bet the rest of the skate after that was fun. And it was enjoyable. And the boys could have a laugh in a moment where they, you know, where it would be tough to have a laugh and everything's so serious. But I love that stuff, though. That's I like, you know, sometimes I've had a captain who we were playing terrible and it was a tough stretch. And we came into the dressing room at the first period. We were down by a handful of goals or something. And the guy stood up and told a joke.
Really?
Instead of standing up and calling guys out and missing that and smashing a garbage can, he just told like a stupid knock-knock joke that would make a grade four kid laugh. And everyone just sort of said, what is this guy talking about? But it just changed the mood. And that can be a big, you know, a big thing, a big changing point in everyone's mentality. And so I really appreciated, you know, that little moment, that hot lap. It might not have been a game-changing event, but for the next 30 to 40 minutes when the boys are on the ice preparing for the game, it shifted the mentality for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I'm looking at Ovi play now, and I'm like, oh, my God, he's turning into Mark Messier in front of my eyes.
The moose.
The Russian moves. Like, I remember you told me a story too when you first got called up to the team. Was he? You said that I think he was the first guy that came up to say hi to you or on the bus or something.
Yeah, he was in New York, so we like, you know, like, we were all filing out of the hotel, and there's always 1,000 autograph seekers and stuff out there. So you have to sort of like weed your way through the security to get on the bus. And Ovi's sitting right at the front, and he was, you know, like I say, he was the first guy that would high five and then jumping on me, giving a hug or something to say welcome to the team, good to see you. So it's yeah, I've always had a lot of respect for the way he approaches his teammates. And I mean, like I said, I think he takes a little bit too much heat as an individual for team success or failure over the past little while. So, but I've never really knocked his leadership in terms of what he brings to a team from a sense of energy, from a sense of desire. All that stuff I think is in line for him. It's, you know, it was time for him to get over that little bump in the road, and hopefully people can start appreciating what he brings to the team from a leadership perspective a little bit more.
Did you see also something in Pittsburgh that maybe was the reason why the Caps got past them this year more than anything else? I mean, I have my ideas, but did you see anything?
Pitt had no secondary scoring this year. I mean, the first two or three games, I think Pitt had 8 goals or 7 goals, and Crosby was in on all of them. Kessel did nothing. They were, you know, Gino was hurt for a little bit, and he missed a game or two of the series. Hagelin was banged up. But like I said, Kessel, when they won last time, Kessel was, in my opinion, the MVP. I mean,
especially in the later rounds. The later rounds, he was by far the best player.
Yeah, and that's been Pittsburgh's MO for these last couple of years, is that, you know, Crosby has 15 points in the playoffs last year, I think it was, in 25, 22 games. That's not the pace he's been on in the playoffs for his whole career. But they find a way to win because Connor Sheary suddenly has 9 goals in the playoffs. And, you know, Gensel does his thing. All these guys that are stepping up, Bonino was huge for them when they won last year. So they just had so many guys that were just clipping away at good contribution levels at, you know, in each round. And this year they didn't have it. So although they were good enough to stay in the games, they just didn't have that secondary scoring to put them, you know, to get them back to where they were. And I thought Letang really struggled. He was...
Yeah.
They were playing a goofy system where they had the D-man pinching down the walls all the time, but they didn't have great center support guys coming up top. So that first game, it almost cost them. They were giving up full ice two-on-ones left and right because forwards weren't recovering back over the D fast enough, where the forwards were committing to pinching second as opposed to backing up and accepting a two-on-two or a three-on-two. They're getting burned down the boards. So I think the system didn't really complement the style they were playing and the way that they had to win games 2-1 if nobody else was going to score but the Crosby line. and they weren't going to do that, giving up 3, 4, 5 goals to a wash every night.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said there. And I think to add to that is that with Letang, especially later in the series, there were just some boneheaded plays that he made where he just got caught out of position and gave the – you can't really – in that series where it was so close, if you spot the team, the other team a goal, that usually ended up costing the other team. You know what I mean? Like that usually ended up being the difference. And I remember there was one goal I think in game 5 where Letang came out on the wrong side with Dumoulin, and then they both got confused, and then I forget who scored. But then that goal, I think it was maybe the Verona goal, I think. But Letang got caught on the wrong side or he just was confused. And then especially on the Ovi goal, I mean the Kuznetsov goal in game 6, you know, that was scored on Letang too. It just seems like he's one of those guys that's kind of starting to go – he's kind of going into the twilight of his career a little bit too, because he's also a guy that he's a good skater, but as the league gets faster, his average speed, I would say, kind of gets even more of an issue.
I mean, it breaks my heart a little bit to talk about guys like this. He's younger than me, so he's a couple years younger than me. Don't tell me he's getting old. He's too slow anymore.
Old man Gordo over here with a beard and
I mean, he's had a couple of rough injuries over the last couple of seasons too, missing significant time and. I don't know, like offensively, he was still doing a good job working the offensive blue line. And, I mean, there's a lot of things he was doing right. He was just getting crossed up on, you know, these defensive entries. The Caps were able to switch positions, or whenever he thought there was going to be a soft dump in the corner, he started cheating over to the other side. And that's what happened on that one breakaway goal. Dumoulin's going to stand the guy up at the blue line. He's assuming there's going to be a chip into the near corner. He's going to go pick it up. He starts cheating over to that side. Puck goes right into his lane where he should have been, and the guy's walking down Broadway. So there's just some reads that were getting crossed up, and I sort of blame the system a little bit for that. D-men are able to play aggressive and play to stand up on the blue line when you have back pressure from the forwards. If there's a big gap between your forwards and your defense defensively, there's just that whole neutral zone is open, and guys like Backstrom are going to go east-west and pick you apart. But I mean, if you have great back pressure and forwards in good position on the back check, forwards have nowhere to go but straight lines forward and dump the puck in. And then once you're dumping it in, you're pretty much putting it into a 50-50 situation. So without Pittsburgh having that system that generates a ton of back pressure, and you're telling your D-men to pinch down the boards and give up odd man rushes, there's just too much time and too many reads. And when you have a skilled team like Washington does and you give them opportunities to make decisions and have time with the puck, they're going to dissect you, and that's, I think, what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they won the neutral zone battle too, which, you know, sometimes they really struggle in neutral, and I felt like they kind of started, as the series went on, they just ate Pittsburgh alive, which is just weird for me to say, you know, because it's always been the other way. And by the way, I looked up how old Chris Letang is. He is 31 years old. I'm 33, and what, how old are you now?
32 and a half.
So I just called Chris Letang an old guy in hockey, and I'm older than him, and you are.
He's a dinosaur, this guy. He's past his prime. You gotta get rid of this guy.
SHL superstar Andrew Gordon. You know, the funny thing is, but you know what? I'm going to stand by my old comment because he's a Carl Alsner old, and I love Carl Alsner. But Carl Alsner can't open pickle jars anymore. Admittedly, I mean, he put that out there that he can't open jars anymore because he's blocked so many shots. And you know, so I feel like Letang has kind of, like you said, he's been injured. He's played a very physical style for a really long time. And it seems like his miles are, at least at the end of this year, were showing. And the other thing to consider too is Pittsburgh's played, what, like 95? Oh, God, I don't even know. It has to be over 100 games over the last 2 years consecutively.
Oh, yeah, they're averaging a ton of games, and that's not including exhibition. That's not including the World Cup, and that's not including, you know, all these extra games that people don't factor in. So, guys, if they're playing every night, they're playing over 100 games a year the last couple of years for sure.
Yeah, and I know that they were asked about that and said it wasn't an issue, but that has to be an issue. Final thing I want to say about the Penguins really quick was during that series, I noticed something that the Crosby line did – throughout the playoffs too, and I wanted to ask you about this. because I want to just see what your reaction is. How they score so many deflection goals. And I'm not talking about like some dude standing right in front of the net. I mean, they're shooting like into the high slot and guys are deflecting it in. The way the Crosby line was scoring this year, it was blowing my mind at times because just the absolute skill. I mean, Crosby scored multiple goals by just whacking the puck out of the air. I mean, it's just his skill is unreal at this point in his career.
Yeah, he's finding new ways to get things done. And I think that's a really neat progression of a guy who's also over the hill in this line of work. He's 30 years old now. So, but no,
it's true though. It
is positioning himself differently, and he's like I say, he's getting it done. He's turning into more of a Datsyuk type player, where Datsyuk never leads the league in scoring, but he'd get 80 points, and he would lead the league in takeaways and stuff like that. He would do a ton of different things that contribute to a team without necessarily being the league MVP. And so perhaps that's the direction he's going. I mean, I still think guys at 30, guys at 32. Still have some outstanding years ahead of them. I mean, Ovi led the league in goals again this year. No one's talking about how he's over the hill, although they did a couple years ago. Crosby held it down.
No, I will say this. No, he is technically, and again, this is more of a statistics point of view, is that guys' prime are around the 23 to 27 year old area in terms of when their best seasons will be. But legendary players, they can have those huge years, but then as they kind of go down the parabola line, let's call that, they kind of stay up at a much higher level than other players, and it doesn't make any sense. And Ovi, I believe he's the oldest guy to lead the league. If not the oldest guy, he's close to leading the league in goals. I mean, the way that he's continued to score, just like, you know, with Crosby, it seems like he's reinventing himself slightly every year, but he's become more of just an unbelievable forechecker, the dominant player in front of the net, on top of his skills. But like Ovi, you literally know how he's going to score, and he still does it, you know, on the power play from the circle, one-timer and in. So I think both players are just completely incredible. And I know that you're a player who plays in front of the net. So I was just wondering if there was anything that you saw where you were just going, wow, I just don't know how they're doing that. You know what I mean?
Well, the shot blocking is such a big part of the game now, and guys are so good positionally, and goalies are so good positionally. You almost, to score, if the puck's not being deflected, it has to be such a perfect shot. So point shots nowadays are virtually useless unless you're deflecting them. And guys in front of the net, defensively, D-men are very good at blocking. They're good at boxing out. They're good at taking away sticks. So the tips have to come a lot of times now from different angles and from guys moving through the slot, like a moving target. And there's so many shots nowadays you see where, you know, Bergeron had a great example where a D-man got the puck, Tory Krug, I think it was, in one of these games, and he looks up, and he just blasts it about 10 feet wide. It ricochets off to the other side, and then it's a tap in on the other side. It's completely intentional. But if you're trying to shoot everything on net, you're going to have 2-3 bodies to get through on top of a Vezina winning goalie. So Pitt's going to have, they're going to have guys coming in at different angles. You want to have depth to your offense, what they call depth, where you got your point shot. You're going to have a guy, you know, in the high slot, and then a net front guy. Net front guys is pretty much here to clean up junk and to, you know, you're still going to swing at the puck if it gets to you. But a lot of tips are going to be going through that high guy who's in motion because he's hard to defend. So it's a different way to try to generate more second chance opportunities. Those tips aren't going to go in all the time, but if the goalie can't read it, it's going to create more opportunities for the second guy, the second or third layer of that offensive depth towards the net.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, with that, I have something very exciting to ask you about beyond your season in the SHL, which had a lot of interesting things that I haven't talked to you about. But the first thing I wanted to ask you about was your first round opponent, and I'm going to try and say all of their names, and it's going to make you laugh. DeGeorgians LF, featuring Capitals prospect and newly signed player Axel Janssen Fizalby.
Nailed it. Yeah, no, the team in Stockholm is it's pronounced your garden, as in like your garden,
Oh, wow. That was actually surprisingly English.
Yeah, your garden. It works out, rolls off the tongue if you really sort of try to put it into more of an English form. And, yeah, Fjolby is the player, the hunter, I guess, as they call him.
Yeah.
He's been known. But, yeah.
Okay, so I just want you to go through everything about him. I mean, like, we saw him in the playoffs. We covered his goals, and they were almost all breakaways. So, okay, he can skate well. But I want you to tell me all about him because I know their fourth line was just crazy good.
Well, let's start from the top, I guess. His hair is outstanding.
I mean, in real life, like, did you want to go up and, like, touch it? Like,
I just wanted to see, like, if he uses conditioner. Like, I wanted to talk to him with the products that make such a head of hair. It's glorious, really.
We might be able to make that happen in another off season in the future. So I just want you to know.
Well, he needs a Pert Plus commercial or something. Who was it, the guy in Pittsburgh, Troy Polamalu?
Oh, God.
He made about as much money off his hair as he did off of the game of football. I think Fjolby could probably do something like that if he markets himself correctly.
Yeah, if he makes it in NHL, I mean, we already made a shirt of him. I mean, we already made a shirt of his hair. I mean, him as a player needs to come along here a little bit more, but his hair is on point and Hall of Fame worthy already.
Yeah, it's going to be, he could definitely have some of this, like, Jager-esque following where, like, Jager's mullet still lives on. Such a great legend of Jager's mullet. This guy could have the same potential moving forward.
I'm going to be honest. Like, I have nightmares that he's going to come to development camp and have a shaved head.
Wouldn't that just be the worst?
Like it woke me up in sweats one night a month ago. This could bring so many page views to RMNB in the future. And then it comes to development camp. He's like, I'm over it. It's too much sweat in my eyes.
Well, I think it's a good way to sort of just get attention because when this guy's on the ice, you're like, who's the guy with the hair?
Yeah.
And he stands out like a sore thumb, not only because he can play, but it's just like, who is this guy with the hair?
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
He draws attention. You always know when he's out there because he just looks different than everybody else, and it's awesome.
NHL players should have flair. Like, they can wear flair.
Yeah.
So they can show, like, who you support, what you're all about, have some personality traits.
Yeah, you can express yourself.
Are you a feeler? Are you a thinker?
Yeah. But the kid can play, though, let me tell you. He's it goes without saying he can skate. So he's just north-south. He can fly. He wins a lot of loose puck races that way, which is why he gets so many breakaways against us. He was killing penalties a little bit during the series. But, I mean, on that team, he was such a young guy. He was playing, like, a third-line role. But, I mean, in Europe, a third-line role is pretty much the same as a second or a first, potentially. They're so – you don't have the same defined, job characteristics. A third line is where you check. That doesn't happen in Sweden. Everyone's playing. Everyone wants to score. Everyone is skilled. So he's he was on a good line, but he was getting some third-line minutes, so there was other guys that would play ahead of him. But he can skate. He kills penalties well. The biggest thing that I think our D-men, and he scored a goal like this in the World Juniors too, that he's so good at attacking hard, and D-men have to commit to protecting the wide lane because he can beat you wide. And then as soon as he sees you take an inch too much of an angle on the wide side, his lateral movement is outstanding, so he gets to the middle and he's able to shoot pucks quickly off of his lateral step. So he's hard to defend because he can beat you two ways, and that's, I think, really important as, as Ovi sort of does the same thing where when he's coming down the wing, he can either step to the middle and shoot through you, or he's going to step to the middle, make you commit to that shot, and then go back outside, and he's too strong to contain. So that's what makes him dangerous, Fjolby dangerous, is he's able to do two things on the attack. And he's got great hair.
Yeah, absolutely. It all comes back to the hair. And perhaps he derives all his power from his hair. Like his hair was super, super long. And so he just had more speed. Okay, I am talking out of my butt. But so when you guys went into that first round series, I would even say that he was perhaps the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think he had at least two game winners. He scored a goal every single game, I believe it was. And, he was one of those guys who, you sort of factor in, you assume that first line is going to be tough to contain, you assume the second line is going to be tough to contain, but as you went down the roster, it was guys like him that were making plays every night on a third line where our third line just, you know, had a tough time keeping up and producing at the same rate that theirs were. So his line was definitely a difference maker. And, I mean, a goal game in the playoffs in any league is difficult to attain. And he was really, you know, putting a hole in us. Big goals, big timing. And so I hate him.
Yeah, absolutely. You should. You should. You know, he actually reminds me, okay, I'm not comparing them as players, but I'm comparing how he came along a little bit, kind of like Philip Forsberg, because I remember watching him play, oh God, I'm going to butcher another league name, the Allsvenskan, the hockey Allsvenskan?
Allsvenskan?
Okay, close. I'm very uncultured, and I apologize to everyone listening. But I remember Forsberg started off his years, his like last year overseas in Sweden a little slow, and he was on the third line. And then right after the World Junior Championship, that second half of his season when he was still under the Capitals' control, he just started scoring almost every night, and he started going to a different level. Like, his skating ability and his confidence just picked up. And it seems like ever since he got back, you know, he got some confidence in the WJC. And when he came back, you know, he still didn't score many goals, but he was definitely a better player. And you just saw everything come together in the playoffs. It was beautiful.
Yeah. The World Juniors is such an important thing over there that, it's everyone, you know, the World Juniors is important everywhere, but if you don't make Team Canada or Team USA, these are teams that, I mean, there's a lot of sort of politics that goes into it, and there's a lot of back scouting and this and that. Sweden, it's you get together with your national team 2, 3, 4 times a year. So it's like if you are being invited to these tournaments in November and October, you're sort of in the national team system. And then to make that World Junior team is just, it's such the epitome of Swedish junior hockey that it does give guys an enormous confidence boost. And on the other side, it absolutely crushes the poor kids who get invited to these prior tournaments and then don't end up making the final national team. So it is a really, really big deal. And the coach that he was on my assistant coach in Linköping my first year overseas, he's the head coach of the World Junior team now. He still lives in Linköping. So I talk to him all the time, and he talks about that a lot, as if, you know, you have to watch guys who are trying out for the team as an 18-year-old, if they don't make it, how do they respond the second half of the year? If they just fold up the tent and have miserable seasons, you can tell a lot about a player mentally. But these guys that come out of these tournaments, come out of the World Juniors, which is some of the stiffest competition in the world of hockey, and then just use that confidence and explode into the second half of their seasons, that also says a lot about someone, a player mentally, and how they can, you know, propel their game by using a higher level of play to stay at that level of play and continue moving forward with their team.
And so this is just going to be a pretty simple to the point question, but do you think he's an NHL player?
I mean, I think
maybe not now, but do you think in the future he definitely will be?
I don't see why not. I mean, it's such a different game, North American game versus, you know, the Swedish game. And there's times where I see him cutting the middle and I think, ooh, someone's going to just Scott Stevens this guy. And it could be career over, Paul Kariya style. But I mean, he's got all the tools, in my opinion. He can shoot. The skating is the biggest thing. He can skate so well, and he's aware out there. He's making plays. He's defensively responsible. He's, you know, 19 years old. He's killing penalties in a league that's very strong defensively. Mm-hmm. I think he's reliable. The coach has put a lot of onus on him for that. So I think there's always a big learning curve when you're trying to play in the NHL, and some guys respond faster than others. But I'm a big believer in you know, the Detroit Red Wings philosophy, where it's good to marinate in the American League for a bit. You've got to learn, and you've got to adapt yourself socially, not only just to the game, but to life outside of what you're comfortable with. And so I think he definitely has, you know, a ton of potential, a ton of upside. But depending on the role that he wants to mold himself into and the role that Washington sees him filling down the line, a lot can go right or a lot can go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about, too, that kind of made me think of this was Jacob Virata. And I know that that's kind of a weird person to talk about now, but didn't you wear his jersey number, by the way?
Still am.
Amazing. That is not lost on me, by the way. Okay, but one of the things this season, and I wanted to ask you this, because I always assume maybe there's something I'm not understanding, is that Jacob Vrana's time in the Capitals organization has been very interesting because he will perform very, very well in terms of, let's say, goals, putting up points. But then there will always be something that a coach may not like where he'll end up sitting or he'll be down a line or he'll get scratched. Like, for instance, this year, I think Vrana got scratched almost 12 times this year. Statistically and possession-wise, he is inarguably a top six player, period. It's not up for discussion. He has that skill. I mean, we see it too. So all of those things are not really up for discussion per se. What's up for discussion is what does he do wrong that let's say Barry Trotz or a Troy Mann will look at his play and be like, I need to get through to him that he's doing this wrong. I don't know if you've seen anything in the playoffs that would maybe explain that. But another example of this is that, you know, game five, he basically won for the Capitals. Like, you know, he had the primary assist on the game tying goal and he scored the game winning goal. He was unreal. But then the next day he's kind of bumped down the lineup again. And I have not understood it at all. Like, I assume it's either something defensively or board battles or an effort thing, but I can't literally see it like maybe a player that has played in the league like you would.
I mean, if you have to go inside Barry Trotz's head to figure out exactly what's going on there, because you know, you could just spin your wheels for the rest of your life and never really know what's going on between the walls of the coach's room. So it's all speculation, and that's all we're all doing. But it's, I think sometimes when a player is getting scratched, especially a player of his caliber, it goes back to learning curve. I mean, it might not be a play where a coach says, you did this wrong and that's why I'm taking you out. It could be an opponent thing. Like, hey, we went from playing a big physical team and now we're going to play a small skilled team. So we want to take this guy out and put this guy in. Sometimes it's easier to take out a young guy who needs to, you know, every now and then see the game from the top, as coaches always tell you. So, I mean, a lot of times it might not exactly be a direct correlation to something he's done on the ice in the prior game. It might just be a lineup change that needs to be done to try to give them the best chance to win. I mean, if you see a guy who's just making turnover after turnover after turnover, or a guy who's on the top six and hasn't scored a goal in 15 games, think, okay, that's time to make a change. But if there's really no direct correlation between negative play, the team losing, and things that this player is doing, then it could just be lineup changes, and he's an easy guy to take out.
Perhaps, and I think that's possible because the Caps do have a lot of upfront skill. If you look at Oshie, if you look at Tom Wilson, if you look at other guys up and down, Burakovsky, they do, in a sense, do have a lot of skilled guys. When you were playing on the Hershey Bears, let's say, and there were really talented, like, high draft pick guys that would come in, when they become good, what is them being quote unquote good? Is it when they're making the correct system reads? Like, is it more about reads and how they win board battles and decision making?
Defensively, that's a big component of it. Is you can see there's a confidence thing too. If the puck's coming up to a winger on the boards, and every time it comes to him, he's chipping it out, then you might say, okay, well, this guy's not turning the puck over, but he's not making good plays either. And there's a difference. I always like to say, like, a defenseman who chips the puck off the glass every time, he might not make the right play, but he's not making the wrong play.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between being a contributor and being a player who doesn't hurt you. So I think there's things you can see in a player where he's making little pop passes into the middle, or he's able to put a player on his back in the D zone and make a strong play on his backhand. So there's plays or skill plays that can dictate a coach's trust in you without, making any significant changes in your game. It might just be a winning puck battles or a communication thing or knowing your position a little bit differently than you did a week ago. And it's so there, you can see a lot of confidence flowing through a player when he's making smart plays in tough situations. And as a young player, those are hard to make. And that's, I think, part of the reason I never was able to stick around in the NHL is I was too concerned about just surviving another game or another day than I was into, you know, building my confidence and trying to make those good plays that put the faith in the coaching staff and make the coaches give me that respect to put me in those minutes to succeed. So, I mean, like I say, it could be anything. It could just be that coach doesn't like the way he comes into the rink in the morning. He might show up 2 minutes before the meeting with a sweatpants and a hat on backwards, and I could just piss the coach off. You know, like this thing.
That'd be me. I'd probably make Barry Trotz very mad.
Yeah, a guy walks in with a bag of McDonald's every morning, 1 minute before meeting. You think the coach is thinking this guy takes this game seriously?
But what if he's really, really good, though?
Good players, as it turns out, are a dime a dozen. Good players, you can find them anywhere. But to find a contributor who's going to help you win is a very different story. So they're growing skill guys everywhere. I've seen them everywhere I've ever been.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a good point, too, though, is that Jacob plays very well with confidence and joy in his game. And let's say that if you're giving him really tough assignments all the time, and I would say that there is evidence in his possession statistics that suggest that he likes playing high event hockey and maybe not great defensive hockey. So I'm going to assume it's somewhere where I'm not saying he's a bad defensive player, but I'm saying that maybe he's still figuring out that side of the game, and maybe he's too aggressive, takes too many risks. Let's say he's a risk taker, maybe, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe he's a skilled guy who's been a skilled guy since the day he put skates on. And so to learn to play strong defensively at the NHL level is very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when I watch him in the playoffs too, he's not bad defensively. He's not playing shutdown minutes, which he shouldn't be. But I mean, he's making plays in the D zone. He's not turning the puck over. He's making strong plays. I liked his game whenever I saw him in the playoffs. But it's funny, going into his first game, you know, everyone in Linköping was all excited for him when the news came out he was going to be playing tonight. And so our assistant coach was his coach in junior, coached him in the Czech, helped him come over and everything to Sweden. And so coach asked us, like, where's the game? We said, oh, like, it, I don't know yet. He said, well, if it's in Washington, he might get a hat trick. If it's on the road, he'll be -4.
Wait, why?
And so that's a confidence thing. He's going to go in and, like, feel the mojo, and everyone's going to be cheering for him. It's his first game. And coach was saying that he plays so well on the high confidence, and so well on, you know, with good energy, that, you know, the sky's the limit for this guy when he's feeling good. But in bad situations, early in his career, as a young guy facing adversity, you never know what's going to happen. So I think he'll grow out of that as he gets a little bit more experience. But I think this playoffs has to help him. I mean, he's making big plays in big games, helping this team get to a place they haven't been in, what did you say, 20 years.
So it's, yeah.
I don't know. I think he's going to you might see a big things from him next season.
Yeah, man, 1998 was the last time they went to the third round. They went to the Stanley Cup final for their only time, and I was, 14 years old. I had gotten into hockey about 2 or 3 years before that, and when they lost to the Detroit Red Wings, I cried in the bathroom, ripped up my Sergei Fedorov cards, and tried to flush them down the toilet, and it clogged the toilet.
Oh, no.
And my parents were very mad at me. But I, to this day, I mean, I think it's stupid. It was very stupid of me.
I wish you would have told Sergey that story when he was wearing
the red. He would have loved it. That was the most pure I've ever been. You know what I mean? Like, I look back at that moment and I say it proudly. Like, some people might be listening to this and be like, wow, I worry for Ian. But no, don't worry for me. That was a good moment.
That was a moment. That was when you solidified yourself as a cap.
Yeah, I'm a Capitals fan forever, no matter how much they hurt me. 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it was the toilet curse. Maybe it was the Sergei Fedorov toilet curse, not the DC Sports curse. Maybe I did it. And I just want to apologize to everyone if I did. So I disrespected one of the greatest players in the game.
Yeah. You earned this curse.
I do want to ask you about your season, because you had another great year in the SHL. And I love talking about the contract situation stuff in Europe, because I think it fascinates a ton of people listening. So, you know, let her rip. You also had a suspension, you know, because you're a dirty player.
Yeah, I did. I took another suspension. It was a bad one, too. I deserved every minute of it, I feel.
What happened? Can you walk me through it?
I still feel shame about this. So, we were playing at home, and so it was early in the season, and I caught word that the Team Canada had a couple of GM, Sean Burke was in the stands and things. They were sort of doing the Olympic scouting stuff this weekend. We were playing against a rivals, HV71, you know, back-to-back games Friday and Saturday. And they're only about an hour away, so the scouting staff was going to come watch us play at home and the next night play on the road. Derek Roy, myself, and another guy, Stefan Elliott, who made Team Canada as well, were all playing the same game. You know, they were going to bundle some scouting trips. So I got word that the boys were going to come down to watch us play. So I was pretty jacked up. Might have had a couple too many shots of Red Bull. I went out first period, scored a goal, one of the nicer ones of the year. So I was feeling really good about things at this point. So I go out probably my third shift of the second period. There's a guy on their team comes into our zone, cuts the middle the way I was describing Fjolby does, drives wide, cuts the middle. He's a right shot, and as he's cutting the middle, I'm coming across left, what Don Cherry would call the trolley tracks. And so he goes to do a little like toe drag move on the defenseman to take a shot, and I'm coming the other way at 100 miles an hour, and my North American brain thinks, good night, sweet prince, I'm going to run this guy over. And I went to hit him, I had him lined up nicely, and as he did the little toe drag move, it changed his position about 6-8 inches, and I went from catching pure shoulder to jaw.
Oh,
and,
no.
Yeah, it looked so bad on the video. And he was down. There was no penalty on the play, so I finished the shift. And when the whistle blew, I saw the replay, and I was, like, rocking back and forth. Like, oh, my God, that was so bad. I killed this guy for sure. And the referees had to watch it, reviewed, boom, instant 5 minutes of game. I got kicked out. The league fined me pretty serious, pretty stiff fine. I sat out 5 games. But like I said, when I watched the replay, and when I go over it in my mind, it was an injury that let me also say the player did not end up being hurt. He left the game, played the next day, so everything was fine. Thank the Lord Jesus. But it was a play that didn't have to happen. He was cutting one way, I was cutting the other. I could have tried to play him a little bit softer, just, you know, be a more stick-on-puck thing instead of, you know, like I said, that Canadian blood coursing through my veins said, run this guy over. But you don't need
when you see an obvious hit probably in your head, it must be extremely hard, especially when you're committed to it, to stop.
Yeah, and but like I say, it's sort of, you know, it's a game that happens fast. And you saw in the playoffs, Kadri, his quotes on, he had a dirty play, but Kadri's comments were like along the lines of, by the time I realized things, I was already committed to the hit.
Yeah, that was awful.
But you commit to the hit when you, like, 3 or 4 seconds before you make contact. You've got tons of time to reroute yourself, and you've got tons of time to make a different decision. And I did. And so I recognized where I went wrong. I apologized profusely both to the player and the league. Because I just it's not the image I want of myself, and it's not the kind of hit I want in the game. If it happened to me, or if it happened to any of the players on my team, I would have went bananas. So, I mean, I earned the suspension, and I wholeheartedly stand by the league when I served it. So I try to learn my lesson, that's for sure.
Well, you know, we can bring this back to, like, Tom Wilson, too, is that do you think that there are certain outliers in the NHL where guys get suspended and – there's something perhaps wrong with them, like Brad Marchand, who can't stop licking people. Great player, but I don't want to go into his mind and understand how that helps the team or anything. But you know, we look at the Tom Wilson hit that injured Aston Reese. I believe that's another part of his game that needs to evolve too, is perhaps decision making, where you're committing, you want to make a big hit, and that's maybe the thing, is that he wants to make a big hit, and you put whatever else happens into the hands of how this guy's going to react last minute, perhaps, right? Because like you said, is that stick drag, you know, you got him, you know, right in the jaw because of that a little bit. It, like, for me, I guess, is that it's such a quick game. A lot of it, the decision making has to be a little bit before, you know, how it's how you approach hits in general.
Yeah,
correct?
Like I say, when he's cutting across the middle from, you know, right to left, and I'm cutting from left to right, you're on a collision course. And so if I don't want to injure this player, there's 100 things I can do to not injure this player or to not even put him in danger. But I chose the one route that has a risk. If I hit him shoulder to shoulder, that's great. Nothing happens. Everything's fine. But I'm putting him and myself in a position to cause harm. And there's different ways to do that, you know, and there's different ways that you can approach that situation. And, you know, Tom Wilson is a good example. A guy who's 6'5" does not need to be taking runs.
Training guys, like
you turn yourself into a human torpedo. He's leaning forward and launching himself to the point where his feet are lifting off of the ice to make contact high. Whether he's aiming for the head or not, whether it's intentional or not, like, he's launching a 240-pound frame at a one-square-foot box, and if he doesn't hit it, disaster occurs. You know, if you don't hit him square on the shoulder, some part of you is going to make contact with someone's face. And
I would say this, is that he's not malicious at all. So he is always going for that, for the shoulder. But I agree with you, is that there's like a 20% chance of that going right.
Yeah. At that, you know, speed, what I mean? The opposing player, even if your positioning is perfect, you can't manipulate the other player to take the hit on the shoulder. You know, guys get suspensions in our league for hitting from behind regularly. I took one a couple years ago where I went in and the player was showing all indications of he was going to, you know, do this. He turned his back and tried to make an elusive move. I just ran into him. I get kicked out and suspended for hitting from behind. I cannot figure out what this player is going to do until he does it. And, you know, if Ashton Reese ends up trying to avoid the hit, takes a shot in the face, he still takes a shot in the face as a result of Tom Wilson putting the two of them in a collision course that could result in danger. I mean, that hit right there, what was he doing? He was trying to get to the red line to dump the puck in.
Yeah.
He wasn't, like, breaking in on a breakaway with a second left in overtime, and it was a desperation play. This is a red line chip-in. It did not necessitate a massive hit.
Exactly, and I think that's the part of his game that has to mature, is that I think he, you know, when he came up, he was put on the fourth line. He always had skill. And I'm not saying that he was going to instantly have skill when he came to the NHL, but he kind of settled for, you know, the coaching staff kind of settled him into a role of enforcer. And I think he enjoys antagonizing people. And I think he feels like that's a big way that he can help the team. And I think it is helpful a lot of times. Like, don't get me wrong, but I just think that you're exactly right, is that it's that he puts himself in a position on these big hits where you don't really need to make that big hit there. I mean, he knocked out Cam Atkinson with a concussion earlier in the series, but the NHL Department of Player Safety didn't have an angle where they could see if he hit the shoulder first, but more than the head. He got the head. It was clear he got the head, but yeah. Like, it wasn't clear if what the principal point of contact was. But it didn't really matter to me because it was a dumb hit. And the fact that he did that on Cam Atkinson, he had two bad hits before that. He hit Brian Dumoulin from behind in the head. Now, obviously, that wasn't intentional, and Dumoulin kind of made that happen because of how he kind of was trying to avoid Ovechkin. But it's once again, why is he tracking him from behind that stealthily when the play is not going to result in anything?
The thing about the Dumoulin hit that upset me, I mean, it was a lot. A big factor was Ovi coming the other way, so Dumoulin had to pull up in order to, like, avoid front-on contact with Ovi. So he had to stop, and that stop sort of put Wilson in a position where he was following through and on his route. It was kind of unavoidable to a certain extent. But Dumoulin's a guy who's about 6'3". So why is his head a factor at all? He's not falling down. He's not on his knee like the Kadri hit. It's like Tom Wilson's a 6'5" guy hitting a 6'3" guy square in the head. It's like that I don't know how having your elbow or your shoulder or your stick that high can be excused.
Yeah, and on top of that is that I'm kind of the mind frame that all head hits should be penalized. Intentional, non-intentional. You know, I think that should be something that should be addressed at some point in the NHL. I don't know what they do in European leagues. Like, I know they're much more sensitive, like you said, with hits from behind, for instance. But where do you fall at this point in your career?
Why I felt so bad and why I wish I didn't do what I did and why I learned immediately from that situation, I will not repeat that same situation again, is because I'm with you. I think hitting to the head and the concussions and the information on CTE coming out in hockey players now is shocking, and there's going to be a lot more of us who have these issues as well going forward, and I don't want to contribute to it. you know, so I don't want it to happen to me or the people I know or the people I love. And so I don't want it to happen to others. So I really think it's a fast game and it's a contact game. People are going to run into each other. There's going to be head hits. There's going to be injuries. But you need to do everything you possibly can to just remind us players, players like me who go out and have an incident, that like this is unacceptable and you have to learn to do everything you can to avoid these situations. And so I think Tom Wilson is an incredibly useful player and an incredibly important player for the Caps when he's done the forecheck and he's just absolutely smushing guys' spines against the glass. And I think that's when you watch, and it's funny to watch actually, because you see defensemen know he's coming, chip the glass, and then spin off and try to get the hell out of his lane because they know when he's out there. He's dangerous in a way that's not going to put guys in concussion protocol. So people know when he's out there. It's that one or two situations every game where he could choose to lay off or go into attack mode, and his brain is still wired a little bit too aggressively where he's going into attack mode and putting people in danger, putting his team down a very important player, and drawing penalties that really don't need to be taken.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree. And I think he's going to get to that maturation as a player, especially soon, because it must be incredibly painful to sit out three playoff games, especially when the team actually advances to the third round. You know, because he's been a part of a lot of the playoff failure around here, so I can imagine it was tough sitting on the sidelines for that. But I also think him playing on the first line and having so much success there, he's going to realize that he's just really that important. And I don't think it's completely hit him yet, but I think it will, especially in the next round. He is going to be – he could be a game changer for this team. And without him on the ice, that's bad. He's a great penalty killer, for instance. So if he's fighting or he's getting these roughing penalties, sure, the Caps playing 4-4 is great for the team, especially if you take off another guy on the ice who's a good player for the Lightning. But he's too good of a player at this point to even be taking or leading the league in penalties. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think he's had so many experimental trials up there. And he goes up and plays on the first line for 2-3 games and then gets shuffled back down in the mix. And then someone gets injured or the team loses a couple games. He goes back up. And so he's been on the yo-yo so frequently with that first line that maybe it does just feel like a trial run where I'm going to stay here till coach wants to switch me out again. But if he can really assert himself as being a contributor, because he brings so much to that line where he's going to play a physical game, and now you got Ovi on one wing and Wilson on the other, like zero defensemen want to go back in the corner and get that puck.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so he's going to stir up so much more room for Backstrom to pick up pucks or whoever's a centerman now, Kuznetsov, whoever's playing with Ovi. He's going to stir up so many loose pucks and create so much real estate for these other guys that it's going to be, he could be an enormous factor for that offense instead of just a antagonist, pugilist, go penalty minute racker upper. So I think he can do some damage if he really commits to the role and if the team gives him a chance to really audition for that role long term. So maybe it does have to set in mentally that he's more of a contributor than he is just something for the media to write about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that's underrated about him is how he has great outlet passes from the boards. He can win board battles pretty well, but then how he transitions out of them, and he's very good at leading passes out of the defensive zone.
Well, yeah, that's an example of what we were talking about with Verana, where Wilson makes those plays where the puck's kind of rimmed around the boards. He's going to have a defenseman pinching down on his back. Instead of just whacking it into the defenseman's shin pads and hoping to God it sneaks over the blue line, he's confident enough and big enough and strong enough where he can take that hit, hold the puck for a second, slide it, in between two defenders to a centerman breaking from the down low position. So he makes those strong defensive plays that the coaches love, that show confidence, that show ability, and that gets him those minutes and that gets him on the penalty kill. Because if you're aware defensively, if you're familiar with the positions and you know what's going on around you and you're able to make those confident plays, coach will keep rolling you, and I think that's a huge factor in his game.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to go back to with you and your season is, so was this one of your biggest seasons, at least in terms of goals?
My first year, I scored 18 my first year. I think I had 16 this year. But my first year, it was a weird situation where literally everything went right. So I think I had like 45 points or something along those lines, 44, 45. And the last couple of years, I haven't even scratched that same number. But I was in a different position on the power play where I'm not in a spot now to get many assists. I'm sort of in that middle hole where Oshie is.
Oh, great, great example.
So you don't, I mean, I'm one-timing one or two pucks a game, and maybe one goes in every 10 games or so from there. But playing that Oshie spot, you don't really get many assists. You're not distributing the puck in and out. And on the first year, I was one of, I think, two right-handed players on the entire team. So I played where Ovi does. So I was one-timing everything from there my first year, and rebounds were kicking out, or I was, once I shot a couple, players would have to come into my lane to respect it. I'd go back to that, to where Carlson is, up to high. And, you know, that defenseman would shoot pucks down. I'd get assists that way. So offensively, I've just been sort of moved around into different positions where your numbers do reflect your positioning a lot of times on the power play. But yeah, so I had some really good success early in the season. I mean, Derek Roy is my centerman all season, and obviously he's a guy who can distribute the puck extremely well, and he's got about 500-600 NHL points in his career. So I'm fortunate to play with good players, but yeah, it was another fun year for me to play with good players and to have some success.
What did you like about the SHL the most?
Tough question. I mean, I think the depth of the skill guys is a really good thing. I think it's, you see so many good players, and every line is competitive, and every team is competitive. So it's wonderful in the sense that every night is a battle, and that you go in, if you're a first place team playing the 14th place team, there's a very good chance it's still going to be a one or two goal game. But on the other side of that, it makes me hate the league because there's never a night off. There's never a night where you're going in and thinking, all right, probably going to pick up a couple points tonight. And
we're playing the Thrashers.
Yeah. Like in Hershey, we'd be playing 3-3. And, you know, you would get Binghamton coming in off a road trip at 2 in the morning to play you on Sunday afternoon. And you just know you're going to roll these guys about 6-0. You just don't have that in Sweden. You just don't have that. The parity is so strong there. So it's interesting. But we also have a ton of good young players, guys like Fjolby, the guy who led the league in scoring. His name eludes me right now. But a Vancouver prospect, he's unbelievable, just really impressive to watch this guy at work. So there's so many good young players coming out of that league that Rasmus Dahlin, who's going to go first overall, he was – played in our league. So the list goes on. There's a ton of really good players coming up, and it's nice to see these guys you play against when they're 16, 17, 18 suddenly walk in to be contributors at the NHL level. It's really cool to watch this league develop players.
Yeah, unreal. So this year you are a free agent, correct?
I used to be. I just signed a 3-year extension a couple days ago, actually.
Oh, really? You didn't tell me.
No.
Breaking news over here.
Sorry. So, yeah, I'm back in Linköping for another 3 years, so it's going to be 6 years in one city for me. I can't believe it after all these one-year deals and trades and waivers and ups, call-ups and send-downs and everything to sit in one place for 6 years. I mean, if you asked me this 3 years ago, I would have thought you were crazy.
Well, you are a great guy. And if you're a good player offensively and consistent, I mean, I can't imagine why anyone wouldn't want you to be around. Now going into the contract negotiations, you told me that you weren't sure how that was going to work out. Can you explain to people how Sweden is with work permits? Because Europe, a lot of guys bounce around a lot, so you staying in one place for 6 years is actually very, very notable.
Yeah. How much time you got here?
Because I mean, go for the broad explanation.
Can we call my agent, get him on the line? He's the expert.
Our next podcast.
On the next podcast, my agent explains the taxes for 1 hour. Get zero listens on that one. But no, it's a complicated game. But when my first 3 years, I went over and I was on what they consider an expert visa. So if I was if I was going over to work at Saab and make airplanes, which is another company within Linköping, coincidentally enough, if I was a mechanic going over to build airplanes for Saab, they would bring me over and say, this guy is a specified worker in this area. We need this. He's coming from Canada. He's an import worker and he's on an expert status. So for 3 years, I get expert status. And that lowers my tax rate. It gives the company, i.e. the team, a break at they pay all my taxes, so the team is has less of a cost to them. And so after 3 years, that all changes, where now they're saying, okay, by this point, your expert status runs out because you could have trained someone in, you could have done the job that you showed up to do. So now if you want to stay, you have to just pay normal Swedish tax regulations the way every other Swede does, which essentially goes up to like 46% or something nutty.
What was it before?
I think that on my salary, they pay about 15% or maybe 20% tax on my salary. But then...
So you saw like a 25, 30% increase in taxes.
Yes, overnight.
Wow.
So what they do to avoid that is they pay us in bonuses, because bonuses get taxed at about same thing, 15 to 20%, and your salary would go up. So what they'll do, if they say, if they're offering you $100,000 on your contract, they'll say, all right, well, we'll give you $50,000 salary, where they pay, you know, 20 or 30%, and then we'll give you a $50,000 bonus at the end of your contract. So it's called a sign-off bonus. So that's how they sort of find loopholes. So coming up on my new three-year deal, my salary monthly is low because they pay a ton of tax on it. I'm, you know, twice as expensive as I was for the last 3 years. So my monthly salary, my monthly income is significantly low, but on both ends of my contract, I get a big signing bonus and a big sign-off bonus. So, you know, at both ends of the contract, I get a lot more money than I will for the duration of the 3 years in between.
That's really cool. Well, that also shows they really, really love you.
It shows a lot of faith. It's sort of rare for a guy to get 3 years, for an import player to get 3 years. I can only name two or three guys in the league who have done that in my tenure in Europe so far. So
wow.
It's... The team showed a lot of faith in me, and I wanted to show a lot of faith and commitment back. The people have been – it's sort of like Hershey there. The people in Hershey just embraced me so wonderfully, and Linköping's been, you know, virtually the same. I really have a connection with a lot of the fans and a lot of the people in the city. So once I left, I packed my bags, and I walked out of there, and I felt like I do not want to leave this place. So I'm very lucky to go back to a city that I love and a team with an appreciation for the way I play the game.
Yeah, that's really cool. What would have been your other options if the SHL didn't work out?
Switzerland is sort of the dream over there. It's the most beautiful country there I've ever laid foot in. And the travel's great. Financially, it works out better. They pay a little bit more than most of the other leagues in Europe. So Switzerland's always sort of the dream. But there's only four import spots on each team in Switzerland, whereas in Sweden you can have as many as you want. So to get one of those four spots on a Swiss team is really hard. You have to be a really high-end skill guy or have a ton of NHL experience or, you know, a resume that says I'm going to score probably 1.5 points per game and that's why you should sign me. I don't have that. I'm more of a, you know, I try to play a rounded game, I should say. So I'm not a pure numbers guy that's going to blow everyone away with, you know, a skill set. So Sweden was a better fit for me. I didn't really have any opportunities to go to Switzerland. The KHL is obviously another option, but I mean, at this point in my career, as you mentioned with Letang, I'm sort of on the back nine, as I should say.
So, that was a good metaphor.
Yeah, I made the turn, and I'm on the back nine of my career. So I spoke to my agents quite a bit about going to Russia and the potential to find me a position there. And they have limited amount of spots for imports as well. And, you know, without a lot of NHL experience and a high, you know, output the last couple of years in Sweden, it was tough to find a job on some of the higher end teams in Russia. And I mean, if you read some of the horror stories, yeah, teams that I would have been auditioning for, sometimes they don't pay the players for 4-6 months. Sometimes they sign you to a contract and then just manipulate it. And sometimes they don't pay you at all. And sometimes there's just so many factors, and a lot of these teams are in cities where you're not, and you can't drink the water, and there's a high crime rates, and it's very different. You have to really settle in and understand, I'm going there to try to make a cash grab, get out.
Yeah.
And so as I was looking into that, I just thought, what am I doing here, man? Like, I got a really good thing. I got a city that I love. You know, I'm making enough money to be happy, to enjoy my life, live a very good life. So why am I slapping that in the face? And so committing, I wanted to commit for a long term if I went back to Linköping, and that's what I was fortunate enough to get, was 3 years.
And if, let's say, that didn't work out, you would probably just bounce around perhaps in the KHL too, right? Because there's not, what I've noticed with, like, especially veteran NHL players that maybe go overseas, is just that there's just so much turnover. I couldn't even imagine it, like, if I was a player, you know?
Yeah, it's tough. You sort of find a job wherever you can. And in a lot of these cities, a lot of these leagues, if you don't really love the city and you don't like where you are, you want to find somewhere better. Because Europe's a beautiful place, and there's so many great cities with teams. So why would I settle for this, you know, place with a dirty old arena that's, you know, in a city that my wife hates it here and blah, blah, blah. If you play a year, take your money. If you don't like it, boom, go somewhere else. But, I mean, I was lucky or unlucky enough to find a place that I really love. So part of me wishes I would have done some of this bouncing around, check out a few different countries and different leagues, see where I fit in. But
it's like a man who settles with a woman too early.
High school sweethearts.
Yep. It's a lot of. You have that high school sweetheart mentality.
You never know what you're missing.
You always assume the grass is greener, and perhaps it isn't.
Yeah, from the 32-year-old single guy.
Oh, that's great. So let's see. I did also want to ask you about a few other things really quickly. Last night there was the longest AHL game of all time. It was a 5-overtime classic between the Lehigh Valley Phantoms and the Charlotte Checkers. 5 overtimes. Apparently, in our story, we learned that a player was actually throwing smelling salts to fans to keep them awake. I don't know if you've ever heard of that before.
Never. That's hilarious. So good for him. People interested.
I know. To think about the fan, like, to not care about the, I don't want to say that he didn't care about the game, but to actually consider the fans. You always assume that there's such a separation between player on the ice, fan in the stands. So when something like that happens, it's just really, really cute to me.
Yeah, but it's a fun interaction. Like, this is that's something that a story should be told to people.
What do you have an AHL game that just went forever long, and what is that like? Because we're in the playoffs right now. Who knows? The Caps and Lightning might go 4 overtimes, and, you know, I know as a fan how it feels, but as a player, what is that like?
The longest one I've ever been in, I played in, like, I think 2 triple overtime games in college, and I think I only went to double overtime so far as a pro. But even those games, like double overtime, feels like forever. Because it's funny, in the course of a regular game, 3 periods, it's not uncommon to have a score be 5-4. But then in this overtime, 0 people score over 5 periods?
Yeah.
Like, statistically, how does that even happen? But I don't know, in the moment, you're just, like, mentally you go to a different place probably after the second overtime, where you're just thinking, like, oh boy, like, this is weird. I don't really know. I'm not really prepared for this. Mentally, you're already kind of checked out. You're tired. It's just it goes into that survival mode I talked about, you know, a long time ago with playing 3 games in 3 nights, where the third game you're just sort of like, oh God, like, don't make any glaring mistakes. Just get through this. You'll be fine. So you're in the dressing room between periods just eating anything you can find. You're changing your underwear. You're putting your gear in the laundry to try to dry it. Anything that'll sort of make you feel fresh again.
Wow, I didn't even think about that.
You feel terrible. Your skates are 3 pounds each by the time you get off that second overtime. Your gear is so wet and so heavy. So I used to take my shoulder pads, my elbow pads off as soon as we go into overtime. Give me a new shirt. Give me a new, you know, throw this stuff in the dryer. So I want at least to feel dry and light for the next period. Come in after this first overtime, do it again. Dry me all out. So there's just it's survival mode by all means. The team's ordering pizza during the period, so it gets delivered. You're eating it in between.
Really?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
I had no idea.
There was a game in Norway last year. I think, no, 2 years ago, where, you know, you can look this up if you have a minute, but I think it went 11 periods and, like, I can't remember if it was 11 overtimes. It was something absolutely nutty, and not a number that didn't even make sense. Joey Tanu played on the team, actually.
Oh, really? Capital.
But anyway, so they went so deep. It was like the team ate all the food, and then, you know, they had a post-game meal for the home team set up. They ate all of that food. Then after a couple more periods, they ate all the home team, gobbled up all the food that they had prepared for the road team. And then they raided after a couple more periods, they raided all the concession stands that had shut down. At the end of the game, there was not a single calorie left in the building. And the road team comes off the ice after 11 periods and is like, where's our food? And it's like, sorry, pal. Like, there's a 7-Eleven 5 miles that way.
You know, I'm not a athlete. I'm a blogger, so obviously I'm not like you, where I actually have fat that I can lose when I play. When you're playing hockey, do you literally just run out of energy? Like I couldn't even understand it probably in my head.
Well, most people, you know, your game day routine, you go and you do your morning skate and you have lunch. So everyone eats a very large meal. You're fueling up on everything you can get, a lot of carbs, a lot of proteins, a lot of the things that you need to sustain yourself. But you're eating a big meal at 11:30 or 12. And then for me, I don't have another calorie until post game, which is 10:30 or 11 by the time I cool down, do a workout, whatever, finish up the day, shower, get home. It's 10:30 at least. So I haven't eaten for 10 hours by then. And if you go to 6 extra overtime or something like that, your body is not prepared to play 3 games in a row. So it's just a matter of absolute conservation. Your body's going to start eating its muscle mass. You're going to start eating anything you can possibly get. When you put food in, if you're especially eating fruit, that turns into energy virtually immediately. It's rushing right into your bloodstream pretty much. So you're just crushing bananas and crushing apples and juice and Gatorade and anything that you can put in you that will absorb quickly. Because it makes a difference between minute to minute. As soon as that stuff hits your lips, it's turning into energy.
Wow, that's fascinating. I had no idea.
A lot of pizza. A lot of pizza.
If that's your advice for me, I like it. Yeah. I can do that. As a blogger, I can do more pizza.
Yeah. Domino's makes a killing on overtime. Love it.
Man, I've learned so much. I've learned so much. You re-sign this and that. So I guess one fun thing is we might actually do a live podcast together.
That's what I'm hoping. Yeah, if I can get down there, find some time. I got my trainers coming to town since Pittsburgh lost. I got my trainer back this week. Thanks, you guys. My strength coach for the summer, he took a job with the Penguins, so he's now down there all winter, and I didn't know how much he was going to come back. So he's coming back this week, but I'm going to get my program worked out, start looking and planning out my next couple months. So if I can, I want to pop down to D.C. and see you guys and spend some time in the district again.
Yeah, and I will make an event so people maybe can hang out with us if you're up for that. I think that would be really, really fun.
Love that. And maybe catch a game if the boys are still rolling.
Oh man. I assume no, but I mean you might have some pull. I mean, I would have to go in as a media guy.
Isn't there something where like alumni get tickets to games?
I think so. You need to look into that.
But I mean, regular season, they're probably not giving away tickets to, you know, the conference finals to guys like me. I played 12 games over 4 years.
I can be your brother. No one will know. Yeah. I went down. I have to tell this story really quick just because you're going to laugh because you're actually famous. But I was checking out my groceries at Wegmans and this guy started talking to me about a Russian Machine article. And he was just talking about a lot of cap stuff and some stuff we had written. And I was like, oh, so you read Russian Machine? He's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I love the site so much. And I was like, oh, my name is Ian Olin. And as soon as he said that, he freaked out. He was like, no. And I was like, yeah, yeah. I created the site with Peter. And he asked me so many questions. He was like starstruck. It was the most adorable thing. And if that's what your life is like it's the greatest thing ever. Well, you know, not because
a lot of fanfare. I feel like I've heard similar.
Yeah, I don't get it.
You get noticed. You get noticed all over the area.
Like it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me because we've been doing it so long and we get a lot of traffic. So the traffic correlates to, in my head, a lot of people know of the site, especially if they're hardcore Caps fans. They definitely know probably the site and potentially me. But it's, you know, I do this by myself in my basement 95% of the time. So you're just kind of doing this and putting it out in the ether. Whereas you're performing, people cheer for you. They go, yay, Gordo, you scored a goal. I don't get any of that. So when I go out and people are so excited, it really is like so emotional. Like I can't really put it into words, but I was just so excited.
You need to take this and run with it and do what the Kardashians used to do back in the day. And like,
oh
yeah, they had to call the paparazzi and tell them what restaurant they're going to, so that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you need to start.
Oh yeah.
You need to start telling people like, yeah, I'm going to be at Wegmans later. Like, it'd be such a pain.
I'm not wearing sweatpants either. I actually put on real pants for this event.
Yeah. Start calling the paparazzi and tipping them off where you're going to be.
I don't look like $100, but I look like $5 maybe.
Touché.
But I, you know what? I want to bring it back to you too, though. Is that in my head? A lot of the stuff that has happened with the site, a lot of people took us seriously when you contributed to us when you were with Hershey, you know, just blogging the AHL Calder Finals. I mean, who does that? I mean, that was so fun and so cool. And, you know, I also feel like that's partly because of you. I know the Meteor had something to do with this wildness too, but it's just really cool that it really is like a baby, you know, the blog is like a baby and you're cultivating it and you always want to make the right decisions. I mean, sometimes I don't make great decisions about what we should do and stuff, but I think most of the time we're pretty good and we're respectful to everyone. And so I just wanted to tell you that it's just, it is the greatest thing in the world. And it's just because it's the baby you created and people love it so much. You know what I mean? Because that was literally the point.
You should have a sense of pride in it. My father's been a big fan since, you know, back in my early days. He loved the Caps, the whole media team, because there's so much coverage. There's so much online to read about, so many perspectives. So my father has struggled ever since I left the organization to find any other coverage that rivals the kind of stuff that you guys and the other blogs in the area were putting out. So it's I think you guys really set the tone for media coverage as far as blogging goes, and thank you.
I noticed that in other cities too. It's not like even NHL cities. It's not like that. And I think you know, maybe Ted doesn't love it now, but I think Ted really loved how if he opened up, you know, coverage to other people, like for instance, credentialing and stuff like that. When he opened it up to a lot of people, the people who did it, you know, like John Press of Japers Rink, Weish, you know, a lot of the guys that came in, you know, Weish isn't a blogger, but I'm just saying the people that covered the Capitals were really took it seriously and professionally and really set that tone where it was a positive thing for the city. And I agree, is that, you know, I feel like I work on this site nonstop, yet I still feel like, you know, if I don't cover something, someone else will. So there's always this pressure, and it's because everyone around us is so good too. So I completely agree with you. It's been an amazing ride, and I don't know why I'm talking about this on the podcast, but
the hardest working guy in hockey, Ian, you're the hardest working guy.
No, not at all. No, Jay Beagle is the hardest working guy in hockey.
But getting back to hockey, I want to ask you, what's your pick? We got Winnipeg and Nashville going to game 7 here in about 15 minutes, if my watch is correct. Yeah.
Yes.
What's your call here?
Okay. So here's how it probably will go. I think Winnipeg is going to win, and it's not really anything beyond. I think they have a lot of confidence playing together. Lane has been unreal. They're just a good team, but inside my, and, you know, and also the fact that it's so hard to get back to the Stanley Cup final, you know what I mean? And I just, it's unlikely for the Predators, but since the Capitals are in the conference final and could very well go to the Cup final, there's no way this could end without them going through either the Predators or the Golden Knights. So I pick the Nashville Predators in Game 7, because I think the Capitals, if they make it to the final, they will have to play either Filip Forsberg or Nate Schmidt and George McPhee. I mean, that would be the funniest thing ever.
And you're right about.
It would be, everyone would be tortured. It'd be horrible.
I'm going to have to unfollow you guys if you have to.
Yeah.
It would be too much saturated coverage. Too much coming at me.
Filip Forsberg, just breathe. More at 11, you know? It'd be awful. Yep. What do you think? What do you think? And who do you have in the Caps Lightning Series too?
Ooh, I mean, I haven't even had time to dissect that one yet. I have a tough time pulling for the Lightning. I don't know if it's the color of their jerseys or the fact that it's like a Florida team. I don't know, but I just can't cheer for the Lightning.
But they play kind of unimpressively good.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've really been impressed with Yzerman. I think he's done a crazy job with that team, and he's so active at the deadline. I'm always impressed by GMs nowadays who make a lot of moves late in the season because the cap is so stiff. It's hard to squeeze guys in and make moves. But he's a guy who seems to find room and makes great moves every single year at the deadline. So I'm really impressed with them as a team. I think their decor is outstanding. I don't think they have a defenseman under 6'4". So, I mean, they're going to be tough to beat that way. They're a big physical decor who can move, skilled. But, I mean, what do you say about Kucherov, Stamkos, those guys? Yeah. You know, they're some of the best players of the last decade. So I think the Caps will have their hands full, but I cannot cheer for them. And I don't know why, so I'm going Caps on this one.
Yep. Caps in seven, baby. It's going to happen. It won't make any sense. Just like the Penguin series kind of made sense, but not really. Like, we could identify some things that were weak with the Penguins, but, you know, just this team.
House money. I think, house money. Can't lose.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's going to be the difference, is that Tampa's going to feel that pressure a little bit more because of their success in the past. I could be totally wrong. They could sweep the Caps in four games. I mean, I think they're a very, very good team and a very, very fast team. Caps really struggle against fast teams. Yeah. But I just think coming out of that Penguins series, the confidence the Capitals are going to have is going to be – I mean, you know, Ovi's giggling about Tom Wilson, I mean, during an interview. I mean, things are weird right now. I don't even know how to judge the Capitals, you know what I mean? Because they're just so weird right now. But, yeah, who do you think is going to win, Predators or Jets?
Okay, that one – I'm a big Jets fan. My father – lived in Winnipeg from when he was 13 till he was about 34. So home for him feels pretty much like Winnipeg. And I used to go visit my grandmother there all the time. And they obviously signed me for a year. And in that organization, I played in the minors the entire season. But I've never been treated better by an NHL club than I was with the Winnipeg Jets. I have absolutely nothing but golden reviews about the Winnipeg Jets organization, and they've gone through a lot of bad years. They've got a lot of guys who, like the Capitals, who get fingers pointed at them for what they can't do, and now they're really seeing the fruits of their labor, and I'm really pulling for them. I think the city is going absolutely bonkers over the recent success, and I think for them to take the conference finals as their first real push in the playoffs would be enormous, and I think that any Canadian market that succeeds like that, I cheer for. But I have a lot of heartstrings tie back to Winnipeg, so I'm a big believer in the Jets right now.
All right, so I got the Predators because I have a very, very bizarre mind about how the Capitals will have success, and you're with the Jets because your heart's with them. I like it.
We'll have to take we'll place a bet on this. Well, I'll text you later. We'll find out something to put on the line.
Oh, sure.
When I visit, you have to, like...
Ethan, doing a diaper for Ethan. How about that?
You have to do that all the time anyway. It's not punishment for you. It's your son.
I'll be honest. I'm always kind of proud when he has a big poop. That's a weird thing. I don't know why I just put that out publicly, but you feel very proud when your son passes a lot of food. You're like, wow, it's working in there.
I believe it.
There was a time when where he didn't poop for 4 days in the first month. And you're scared. You're like, he's dying. He's not pooping. Something's wrong. Something is wrong, and he's dying. Because that's how you think anything, you know? Like, when you have a kid, it's like, you know, he bumped his head. He's dying, you know? That's the first thing you think. So I treasure every one of his poops and anything he does. So
I'm glad he got through that. He's resilient. Not an easy thing early in life.
Well, thank you so much for your time. You know, maybe we'll figure out something where we can do stuff after games or stuff, depending on your hockey bedtime. But thank you for catching up with me. It was so wonderful, and congratulations on the 3-year deal. And let's hope for some more hockey after even this series too, all right?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and good luck to the Caps. I'll obviously be watching every night, and hopefully we'll have plenty more success to talk about here soon.
Awesome. All right. Bye, Gordo.
Bye.
Bye.
Russian Machine Never Breaks, the podcast. But now it's over. Nothing to see here. Move along.